Welcome, everybody, back once again to Season 5 of Food Conversations. Again, we begin by acknowledging that we are living and working on the ancestral, unceded, and essentially stolen lands of the Shkrepik people, and that fairly resolving this situation is an ongoing responsibility for all of us. Now, today I'm very pleased to welcome to the studio a hardworking member of the Salmon Arm community who is playing a very active role in bringing food issues forward into the public space. Jim McEwen is the fair manager for the Salmon Arm Fair, which takes place every fall in the fairgrounds in the heart of the city. And Jim has a wide range of business and management experience honed on both sides of the Rockies, and he brings this expertise to this annual community celebration, which he has been coordinating for the last 3 years. This year, the fair will take place from September 8th to 10th, and as you will learn, thanks to Jim and a wide range of food advocates in this area, we'll feature a number of events and processes that are helping to rebuild the food system in the Shuswap. Welcome, Jim, to Food Conversations.
Wonderful. It's great to be here, Warren. Thank you.
We're very happy to have you here, and I think our listeners are going to learn a lot about the fair and about what you've been accomplishing in that context. Now, I was almost going to say the conventional line about how managing the fair isn't your first rodeo. And then I recalled that you've been involved with the Calgary Stampede quite a bit. And in fact, one of your mentors, Rock Spence, was a longtime volunteer at that famous event. So what did you get involved with at the Stampede? What were you doing there?
So thank you for that. And Rock is he's a gem. He's one of those people that would give you the shirt off his back. And when you talk about mentorship, it's we've talked about this before, but there's positive and negative mentors. And Rock started as a gopher as a volunteer with the Stampede and worked his way up to a board of director with the Stampede. And the one thing I found about the Stampede is it's just an amazing organization. They treat their volunteers magically. And their total focus is on the patrons getting a great experience. And but they're never stopping to sit on their laurels. I mean, they work directly with the Indigenous communities, which I really thought was fabulous. And they
right
did that
from the,
right
from the
start.
Beginning, yeah.
That's right. They started that, you know, that's way back in the days when Guy Wiedek started it. And they sat down with the Treaty 7 and they sat down and talked about the role that Indigenous communities can play in the experience of the Stampede. Mm-hmm. And today it's, you know, even with, I know there was a lot of elders that would be in their teepees and the patrons would come up and speak with them about life as, you know, on their reserve. Mm-hmm. And a number of guests would come up and talk about the residential schools. And I thought, wow, that is a tough subject. Mm. The elders are so classy,
yeah,
that they would talk candidly about their experiences.
What they had to go through, yeah.
And I think the non-Indigenous community can learn a lot from that. I think a lot of non-Indigenous community has no idea the emotional impact that residential schools has, not only those that were impacted, but also the entire community. So,
and the multi-generational.
And the multi-generational, yeah. And the thing is, the Stampede never shied from that. They stepped up and supported the Indigenous community, and still do to this day. And I think it's a testament. So when you ask about my role was pretty minor. When I worked on the parade committee, and we had about 250, 300 volunteers, mm-hmm, that worked strictly on the parade.
And that's an important point, that the volunteer contribution to the Stampede, as it is also the case with the Fall Fair here in Salmon Arm, is really central. It's all the board for our fair here is all volunteer.
That's right.
And it is volunteers often who keep the whole show on the road. If they weren't there, there wouldn't be this kind of central event in the community, both the Calgary Stampede in Calgary and the Salmon Arm Fair here.
Yeah. In fact, you look at any organization that runs an event or that operates requires volunteers. And the impact volunteers have, you could never pay someone to do the work that a volunteer does, because generally most events will work volunteers all day.
Indeed.
and in our case, all day in the heat.
And, yes. Had usually, that experience too, yes.
And then at the end of it, you know, we thank them and they carry on, and they may go volunteer for another organization, or they might just wait until next year and be back.
But, and getting something out of it for themselves.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, one of the things about the Stampede is that there are a lot of animals involved. And animals have actually been, they have a connection in your life going right back to your childhood.
Yeah.
Your father, when you were born and had your early years in Yellowknife, was a research biologist studying caribou.
Yeah, yeah.
What do you remember from these animals? You would have been small and they would have been big. What was that like, you know? Actually, you were involved with them directly sometimes.
Yeah.
What was that like? Talk about that.
It was a brilliant upbringing. So Dad had a number of caribou and reindeer that were shipped back from the north, and it was called the vivarium. And off the top, we might have had 20 cows and bulls. And as a kid, Dad would weigh the feed, and it was basically like a kibble. Mm-hmm. And my job was to slide it in a tiny little slot, and it was on a almost like a little tray and slot, and then the caribou or reindeer would come over and eat. Well, and then we would also weigh calves.
And how old were you at that time, roughly?
Oh, I would have been grade 4 and 5.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So that was, and then the other part of that, our job was to help weigh the calves.
Mm.
So it was really fascinating, but during the rut, so when you ask about
mind
what
yourself.
Do I remember? So there was some bulls there that had pretty good sized racks, and they had zero patience for two-legged
human intervention.
And so when you opened up the door to slide this food tray in, you had to close it quick because that bull was coming right at that that door. So, but it was,
and
it
you
was
were
great.
You would have been physically small at that time, and they would have been pretty.
Oh, they were huge.
Yes,
they were huge. And Dad also worked with mountain sheep and studied the mountain sheep. And again, it was great because we did the same things. And I remember cleaning out pens, and you'd get a big ram that would come over and knock your wheelbarrow over because it could.
Yes, right. Couldn't knock you over because you weren't accessible, but there's something else.
But and it would, it was just watching the lambs, you know, jump around the pen that they were in. It was a great upbringing, and I think, you know, from that you just have you've got a strong appreciation for wildlife, but you've also got a strong appreciation for the environment. And the world we live in. And really, we're pretty small in the whole scheme of things.
Absolutely.
You know?
And we sometimes think we're not, which is a big mistake.
It is.
Now, your dad was very dedicated to his work, clearly, and he was obviously a mentor.
Yeah.
What from him did you pick up? What kind of qualities do you feel when you look back are, that's something that Dad modeled for me or drummed into me or whatever?
I think it was probably a work ethic. Dad, oftentimes he worked 7 days a week. You know, Saturday and Sunday weren't full days, but those are the days that I would go out with him. And it was probably just his work ethic and his passion, maybe his stubbornness, because he had, I remember one time he talked about, because it was the Canadian Wildlife Service, which was part of the government. And I remember talking to him one day about, what does a minister know about wildlife and the job that you guys are doing? And they're making decisions that
not
affect
a lot.
Well,
not a lot.
So it was one of those things. And Dad had a very candid reply. And I still remember he said, they don't.
Period.
He wasn't, he was very much a scientist. And, I remember, in high school, my science classes, I love science, and I did a a piece on Drosophila, or fruit flies.
Mm-hmm. Yep. So David Suzuki's favorite friend.
Well, Dad, of course, knew David Suzuki, mm-hmm. and so I got a bunch of cheat sheets from Dr. David Suzuki, which was kind of interesting. But, of course, the teachers would look at my work and go, well, who did this work for you? And they don't realize that it's – I think the science was in my genes as well, and it was just part of my DNA. But I just found it quite interesting.
I'll just mention to listeners, once again, I'm speaking with Jim McEwen, who is the fair manager at the Salmon Arm Fair. You left Yellowknife. You moved to the big city. You came down to the Lower Mainland. That must have been a bit of a culture shock for you. You know, instead of very large animals all over the place, there were very small animals and a lot of two-legs everywhere. What was that like?
I was very little. I was very small at the time, so... I think in every place you move, we've lived all over the world. Dad did work in Aberdeen, Scotland, so we lived there for 2 years. We lived in Montreal. We lived in Edmonton. But our longest stretch was probably Vancouver. And you just adapt.
Yeah.
You know, you just adapt to your surroundings, and you take what you can from it.
A lot more people.
Yeah.
Schooling would have been a crowded place.
Schooling was crowded, but it was still good. I mean, we had a really active school. We had our high school was phenomenal. We had great teachers. Mm. I was involved with a project that the Vancouver School Board was testing. It was called Quest, and it was the first time that they had ever tried almost like an outdoor education program.
That would have suited you up.
Oh, it was natural. The only problem was our teachers were Montreal Canadiens fans, so it was a little difficult.
Well, that was a big challenge. Very, very tough thing to live through. In Vancouver, you then moved on to university and Simon Fraser.
Yeah.
But instead of going to biology, you went into business. You got a Bachelor of Commerce degree. Yeah. Now, what was it that moved you from an area that you had a strong affinity for and lots of experience in, into a business approach?
Yeah, that's a good question. It was my mom was a graphic artist, so I think you know her influence on marketing and visual was a contradiction to Dad's scientific side. Mm-hmm. So I got both, and I had a friend of mine that was involved in radio. And radio sales, and I really was attracted to marketing.
Yes.
And,
so it was marketing. It wasn't just all of the business community's aspirations. It was marketing that interested you.
It was very, and I just found it fascinating that you could create a piece that would motivate people to do what you wanted them to do.
For sure.
Whether it was graphics or whether it was voice or audio or
So with marketing, you're finding ways to get into people's consciousness, you know, to change them. And it could be marketing to sell a product, or it could be marketing to sell a concept or motivate people to change their behavior, that kind of thing. Was that the sort of thing that was part of what you did when you got on into business activities? That was your sort of forte?
Yeah, and I think I still do that today. I look at opportunities that I think would be good for either an organization or a community or people. And then I research the heck out of that idea. And
your father was a research biologist.
He was,
you had no chance.
I had to research. So I think what happened is I took that concept into business, and whether it was managing or owning, and but also did that in the volunteer side.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's social marketing.
Yeah.
And social marketing is just the same as product marketing. It's just it's a different kind of product.
Exactly.
In the early 80s, you went to Calgary. That's Calgary became your home for quite a long time.
Yes, it did.
What was going to Calgary meaning to you since you'd done your degree at Simon Fraser, you'd lived on this side of the Rockies for a while? What was it made Calgary seem like an inviting place to go to?
I think the youthfulness of it. I think the opportunity. Now, I had no idea what to expect when I arrived in Calgary. We had some friends there, but I landed a job actually in a radio station.
Really?
Figure.
Your first job?
In High River.
High River.
CHRB High River.
Really? And what were you doing? Announcing? And
no, I was an ad sales guy.
Oh, there you were. Your marketing skills were put to a test.
Put to a test. So there I was, and I listened to, it was quite funny. I happened to actually be listening to Led Zeppelin the morning I left Vancouver, and I arrived in High River and was listening to Hank Snow. So
that sounds like the cultural norms of each place were adequately represented.
Yeah.
Did you find working in sort of this, not a large community, but it's a sizable town. So you've been in a big city, you've been up north, and now you're in a sort of a media side. You're obviously getting a lot of different kinds of experience in different cultural milieus.
Yeah.
What was it like being in High River after being in the Lower Mainland?
Loved it. Just loved it.
What did you like?
The people. Mm. They're very open, very friendly. In fact, I think that's one of the strengths of the people that lived in Alberta at the time was they're very welcoming. And
you said something about Calgary being that way then, and there have been changes since then.
Yeah,
it was the same open attitude when you were there.
Oh. I would walk down the street, and people would look you in the eye and say howdy. It was really
say howdy.
They would. Oh yeah, I still say howdy, which is I'm sure people look at me like.
Grand Old Opry, or what are you doing?
That's right. But it's it was just the that openness and friendliness that you know, Vancouver's a great town, great city, great beautiful city in the summertime, but it has a certain maybe attitude that Calgary didn't have. Calgary was very welcoming, and I mean, I was in media, so it was easy for me to meet a lot of people in a very short time. And it was great. It was a small town. I mean, it was by comparison to Vancouver.
And you spent a long time in Calgary and did a lot of things and a lot of things to do with different businesses.
Yeah.
At one point, you said, when we were talking the other day, you said, my forte is growing businesses.
Yeah.
And you'd been part of, created some, sold some, bought some, worked for some. Why don't you describe the range of things you did? Because obviously the more you do, the more experience you have and the more you can adapt to new situations.
Everything from screen printing on small pens to school fundraising.
Were you actually putting the
logo
on the pen?
Yeah. In fact, our big client was CPR. Go figure. School fundraising was a big project. And then I think we had a couple other tasting companies that, so the sampling companies in Alberta at the time, you could work with different liquor producers. And I had covered all of Alberta. We had people in Edmonton, Lethbridge, Red Deer, Calgary, and they would go into a liquor store and clients would come in and sample the product, and that was the business.
It's interesting. Speaking of companies that produce alcoholic beverages, you got connected with a very important Calgarian, a very important business person, Ed McNally, who at age 60 started up, after being a lawyer and a farmer for many years, started up Big Rock Breweries. And I looked up his obituary because he died at 89, not so long ago.
Yeah.
And here's what they said about him. They said, a pioneer who sowed the seeds for Canada's craft brewing movement, a risk taker who launched a new venture when others his age were preparing to retire, a philanthropist who was larger than life within Calgary's nonprofit and artistic communities. Ed McNally was all of these and more. When Ed McNally was 60 years old, a successful farmer and lawyer, he decided to take on an industry dominated by three giants, Molson's, Labatt, and Carling O'Keefe, and started brewing the kind of beer he wanted to drink.
Yeah.
Tell me what Ed McNally was like and how he kind of impinged on your life.
Well, again, if you look at mentors now, I didn't work with Big Rock. I was, as I mentioned, I was their unofficial sampler to make sure quality control was up to snuff. So that was my
Friday. A terrible job.
It was, yeah, the fringe benefits were nice, but yeah, horrid. But Ed McNally was, he was so passionate. So when you talk about why people do what they do and you know, Ed was so passionate about producing a quality product. He hired a brewmaster out of South Africa and he hired the right number of people who would work for free, basically. Mm. My brother was one of them, so I knew firsthand. So Ed was one that he would walk the floor. He would ask every staff member how they were doing. He knew about their family. He knew.
He was very hands-on.
Oh, but he cared. Yeah. I think that's the other thing that
he wasn't doing it as something he read in a manual. He was doing because that was his nature.
Yeah, and he was very much that way. And he was the most unassuming person. And he had a very dry sense of humor.
Always useful.
Yeah, always useful. But he, you know, he was just very, very driven, and he wanted people around him. He surrounded himself with people that were like-minded, and again, he couldn't afford to pay them great sums of money, so he created this wonderful environment to work in.
So people actually worked to him because of the kind of workplace he'd set up.
Exactly, exactly. So again, when you take a look at where, you know, for me, I look at when I want to create a work environment, I would emulate or try to emulate what Ed created. And it's not easy, but you have to work it every day, and Ed did.
And in the long run, it's always worth it. Oh. You get gains out of it. I remind listeners again that I'm talking with Jim McEwen, who is the fair manager at the Salmon Arm Fair. Now, speaking of mentors, sometimes, and you alluded to this earlier, sometimes mentors are negative mentors. They do things that you look at and you say, I'm not going to be doing that anytime soon. And one of them was a gent who worked at the Calgary Sun named Bob Jelinek. He affected how you do what you do. What was it that he did that made you say, not so good, I'm not going to do that?
How he treated people. Mm. So on one spectrum, you've got Ed, who treats staff as family. And on the other, you've got a person who treats staff like they're disposable.
Throwaways.
Yeah, and if you can't step up to my level of the game, then I don't want you around.
Did you see the effects of what he did on the people who were working for him or with him? Probably for him more than with him.
Yeah, and I mean, at the Sun, it was, we had a good, we worked in all areas. So again, I was in advertising, but you worked with the editorial people, you worked with composing room people. So it was, you got a good sense of all areas of the newspaper business. And yeah, he was somewhat respected, but he wasn't liked.
Hmm. He was respected and also feared, maybe, because he could turn on somebody if he didn't think they were up to.
Yeah. Well, there's a great line. It's interesting. It's one that I've used on my kids, and it's better to be feared than loved.
Okay, Jesse.
Jesse and Justin. Yes. But yeah, it was, and I can't even remember where I picked it up from, but it was probably from Michael Douglas in that Wall Street movie. But it was something along the lines of, it's better to be feared than loved. And I thought, you know, when I talked to the boys about it, I said it was tongue in cheek, but there are people out there that do.
They mean it.
They really mean it. Absolutely.
And people do fear them, and they get what they want, but they also miss something that in a community is very important. That's a fellow feeling, like you're on the same page, you're working in the same direction.
Yeah.
Looking back on these decades of work in the business community, because you're still indirectly involved, but in a different kind of way in this town, how would you distill what you learned and how it prepared you, say, for what you're doing now, which is managing a community venture that's community-wide in its impact or in its engagement, and which you brought your skills and your instincts to. Mm-hmm. What would you say?
Yeah, I guess I think you have to respect the legacy. Again, I enjoy reading. I enjoy reading history. I'm just finishing a book on Seymour Arm, and you know that they had a fair, the Seymour Arm Fair in 1915. So, you know, one of the things I look at is remember, this is not the Calgary Stampede. This is not Big City. Focus on the strengths of this fair. We're not even the IPE. It's a small community heritage fair. And when I ask people what, you know, I could bring in, you know, a mini version of the Stampede. But why? It's most people want to be able to go up and touch a baby goat. They want to hold, you know, a chick in their hand. They want to get their face painted. They, you know, you focus on the strengths that we've got, and, you know, the thousands of exhibits that we get where people can walk through and see, you know, great baked pies and baked bread and fruit and vegetables. And
somebody's name on it that they know.
Yeah, and somebody's name on it that they know, or that they can say, hey, you know, I got first place, you only got second. So it's
bragging rights.
Exactly. Well, it's kind of like what the fair was back in 1897, mm-hmm. why they started up. They, you know, they could share stories, and how did you grow such a gorgeous tomato? You know? So they was very much involved with, my focus is stay focused on the community and what is in the best interest of the fair.
I can see that coming out. The first time I met you at the fair, we came with some ideas with the Shuswap Food Action Society, and it was an interesting experience to be welcomed right at the door and brought in, as opposed to something, well, there's a form you have to fill out and there's a document you need to sign and that kind of stuff. So business experience in a big city, and then, as is typical for most people, the personal circumstances in your life changed. Your wife's mom was in need of support. She and your wife was from this part of the world initially. So you came back to Salmon Arm, or she came back to Salmon Arm, and you came along. I've had people tell me that their spouse said, I'm going to go to someplace. You're welcome to come along, but I'm going anyway. And you settled in here, and a job came up that took you back to some of those roots in the animal kingdom, and that was managing the Shuswap Veterinary yeah. Clinic. What was that like? What was that like finding, getting back into that kind of work?
Magic. Just magic. It was, I told the owners of the clinic at the time, I said, I am in the best world that I could be in, because I could work on the business side, you know, work with clients, but I was able to get close to animal care. And the veterinary world is a really interesting world. It's not like human medicine. The doctors that are involved because they've got just such a strong passion to help animals.
And animals are so vulnerable compared to humans. Humans you can have a conversation with, but animals you have to sense what they need and meet it.
It's, yeah, the diagnosis of ailments is like the dog can't tell you, the cat can't tell you. And it was really, I loved it. I just loved it. It was even our dog that needed an exploratory because it ate something. So I'm in there. I had my mask on, which dogs do. I had my mask on, and I asked the doctor if he would mind if I watched. Well, most people, of course, wouldn't want to be in there watching their dog get opened up.
Yes.
And but it was just I just found it just fascinating. And the doctors, again, when you talk about mentors, they were fabulous mentors to the up and coming veterinarians. So we had a great staff of reception, CSRs, which they're the hardest working people I've ever come across and are amazingly busy. the kennel staff, brilliant at what they do, and of course the technicians that, you know, they, everybody worked as a team. I think that's what I really enjoyed about that experience, in addition to just being there. One of my best experiences was, and it just showed how the team came together. So Dr. Bose was doing a C-section on an emergency C-section on a golden retriever, and this dog, one pup, two pups, there was 11 pups that came out. And so it was all hands on deck. We had reception there. We had kennel staff. We had the technicians. I was in there. And it was just, you know, again, one of those wonderful experiences that you will remember forever. And all 11 pups survived. And I actually took a video of three or four of the pups that were nursing and the sound that a puppy makes when they're nursing. Like, I mean, that would just put you to sleep. If you ever have a problem sleeping, forget about the pills. Just listen to this puppy just nursing. And so it was a great experience.
Taking you back to your roots in a certain sense, I wonder if there's something about a business that treats animals. The animals affect how the business functions. I'm only saying that because in some settings, animals like horses have been used to train doctors. I'm a family physician for many years. And in New York, there's a medical school that has taken medical students to work with horses so they learn to be honest emotionally. Because with an animal, almost every animal that we interact with, they sense better than we sense them. They sense us. They know if we're on edge. They know if we're upset. They know if we're frazzled or if we're frightened.
Yeah.
Did you find that there was a sense of the animals having, in a sense, the dominant role in the business? They were the ones who shaped the business.
I think animals do play a huge role, obviously, in that clinic. But I think I think they do, because you're constantly aware of their mood. And you're trying your best to ensure that they're comfortable, right? So we know that when they come in and their pet parent or the owner is walking in with them, the owner is anxious. So dogs and cats, of course, pick up on that. So our role was to calm the owner. And ensure that that their pet was comfortable as well. And there's a number of things that you can do that, you know, remove them and put them in a quiet room until the doctor is ready to see them. You know, just keep them in a quiet area. For the most part, though, I was really impressed with how calm pets were. We didn't have a lot of issues, but I think it was just our whole nature. I think, you know, the receptionists were so calm at dealing with all pets that come in and their owners, and then the kennel staff were professional at what they did. So It was, I think you're right, though. I think to focus on the needs of the pet, which I think most vet clinics do, right from the time that they walk in till the time that they leave, that basically drives a vet clinic.
Yeah. Now, here you are doing this dream job, and suddenly, for 3 or 4 years working the vet clinic, you're managing the fall fair. What did they have to say to get you to leave this wonderful world of animals?
Yeah. Well, I think when you look back at my personality, as I mentioned, I like growing things. I like building things. I had done what I set out to do with the vet clinic. And we had a great staff. I was proud of that staff, really proud of that staff. And there wasn't a lot I could do beyond where I was. And I'm not a good person to sit idle. I just don't do well. So we
we'll tell that to the board. They'll be happy. They'll be happy to hear.
That's right. I and my wife is actually the practice manager there now. So it kind of all in the family.
Keep your oar in. Foot in the door. Yes,
that's right.
So, what was it about coming to the Fall Fair that drew you in? Obviously, you wouldn't have done something if you didn't feel you could contribute and you wanted to contribute.
Yeah, I think I looked at it as again an opportunity to grow, and not necessarily in terms of people, but in terms of what the fair stands for. Mm-hmm. It is the hub of the community. I think that it's unfortunately dismissed as, oh, well, it's just the fair. And that's why, you know, I look at the history of it, and I look at the pioneers of this community and those people that built the community on logging and farming. And you know, it wasn't just men. The women worked as hard as the men did. So,
absolutely.
Yeah, so I look at our role in this community and how I can impact that role. I find it just bizarre that the fair has very little, if any, Indigenous. Like, it floored me. I looked at that and I'm going, number one priority is we need to have a gathering place. We need to have an education. You know, we need something that we can actually communicate our Indigenous community.
Mm-hmm. And in fact, that's the beginnings of that process are starting to take place. You've been working with Kenton Thomas, mm-hmm. I understand. What kind of conversations you're having with him, and what sort of plans are you drawing up together?
So he's a fabulous person. I love him. He's got such a great outlook on life, and he's a great storyteller, as we all know.
Yes, we do.
But he and I were talking, and I said, I would love to see an Indigenous gathering place, an Indigenous presence, not just during the Fall Fair, but throughout the entire year. So school groups or people can go into this, whether it's a kikuli or whatever it looks mm-hmm. like, and learn, mm-hmm. you know, 9,000 years in one area. Are you kidding me?
I know when somebody says to one of us, you know, you've been here quite a while, you know, three or four decades, I think we all sort of think, well, gee whiz, maybe that's not exactly precise.
Well, and reading this, the Seymour Arm piece, there was a gold rush there, and, you know, back in the late 1800s, and I'm thinking, oh, wow, that's quite a while ago. And then I stop and think that, well, no, like Kenton's relatives be here for 9,000 years.
There was a couple of generations back out of sort of 800 generations.
Well, yeah, so he and I had talked about what this should look like, and he had a great idea. He said, we should just bring parties together, bring the elders together, bring the community together, bring Roots and Blues in on this, bring, you know, city councilors if they want to be part of it, like bring the community together and say, what should this look like? Instead of us saying, this is what it's going to look like.
Sure.
And
sure.
I thought, brilliant. You know, have the Métis Association, have everybody involved, and those that want to be involved, great. Let's sit down. What should this look like?
Just remind listeners that I'm talking with Jim McEwen, who is the Fall Fair, the Bear Manager for the Salmon Arm Fair. It seems to me that right now we're in a process of social transformation in many areas. We're facing issues that we have to deal with, like climate and pollution and the loss of biodiversity. And in a way, the process you were just describing is kind of an antidote to that fragmentation that has led us to the kinds of problems we have now. Do you see it in some way as part of the process of reconciliation? I mean, a meaningful part of that process. It's a working process to establish reconciliation.
I guess I've never been a big fan of following a government term that they've got. I just, you know, I would rather us just do something homegrown, but do something that's right. And it's long overdue.
Let me just bring something up, which we mentioned in our conversation, and that was the impact of the National Energy Board on people that you got to know really well, who you saw had been really harmed in a very material way by the process of the National Energy Board. I mean, I think people hear the story of the politics of it, but they don't necessarily hear the story of individual people who faced ruin or close to ruin.
It was a very dark day when first Trudeau brought out his NEP program, and I still don't understand the rationale behind it, other than he didn't like the West.
Or he didn't understand the impact of what he was saying. He might have thought in some ethereal way this has some value to it.
Sure.
And what you've talked about and your reason for getting into the business world was to understand how people's minds work, so that if you offered them something, they would be interested in it because you'd speaking to values that matter to them.
Yeah. Well, we spoke about this. Decisions should be a win-win situation. You know, a lot of times in the business world, it's a win-lose. Large corporations, you know,
that's their specialty.
Their ultimate goal is profit to shareholders.
Indeed.
And they keep their jobs. And, you know, it would be nice if, and maybe this is just utopia thinking, but it would be nice if we focused on what is the best for this community.
Yes.
And I've always believed that if you focus on what's best for the community, good things will follow. And in a business, profits will follow. Right? Askews is actually a classic example, speaking of your sponsor. I mean, they've done amazing things in the community. They support so many organizations.
Yes.
And, you know, and they're growing. So
It's a sort of magical secret that everybody knows, but not everybody pays attention to.
Exactly.
Well, I think we'd be doing our listeners a disservice if we didn't talk about some of the processes that you've helped to facilitate at the Fall Fair, which augment things that have been done already, but are, as they say, in the wheelhouse of the fair from the beginning. So let's talk about some of the specific things. First of all, one element that's really quite prominent in the fair this last time around, and that's Buckerfield's Urban Agricultural Program. Buckerfield's has sponsored it, but it's a program of presentations running all the way through the fair. How did that come about, and how is it structured?
So it was a collaboration with Melanie and the Food Action Society, and I said, how do we educate people more on the goings-on of food, and specifically...
Because you heard some comments from people that indicated they didn't have a clue that food mattered. I mean, they like eating and they like going to the store, but they didn't understand that it came from somewhere.
Where does our food come from? Like most, and you know, whether it's most people think that, yeah, it just happens and it occurs. And I think COVID, and I think our the flooding of number one, which really impacted our food transportation.
Empty shelves all over the town.
Right. So all of a sudden people had an aha moment, and it was, oh my God, what are we going to do? We're not going to get our Twinkies, let alone...
Thank heavens. Sorry, I didn't mean to say that, but it just came out.
But I think it was... So the average person was affected. Hmm. And as soon as the average person is affected, all of a sudden it's like, well, you need to do something about this.
Sure.
And I think, again, you could ask government to do what they do. But you know what? I would pose... let's see what we can do as a community.
Sure.
So right now there's little trust by consumers in big corporations supplying their food. They failed.
Mm-hmm.
The system fails. Yet you go to a farmer's market and you can talk to the farmer. You can ask him, hey, what do you do to make this grow so, you know, the smell,
indeed,
the tomatoes, you know, that smell
sure
is brilliant. And so there's a change and a shift in food system trust.
Indeed.
And so then I started thinking, well, we are an agriculture fair. Why don't we promote growing at least some of your own food? You're not going to obviously grow all of your own food, but at least fruits and vegetables, and maybe open up the eyes of the average person to how to do this. Because we've lost that ability of what our grandparents did. You know, they survived because they're very sustainable. They relied on their own gardens.
And there's a saying that you don't protect something unless you love it. Mm-hmm. And it seems to me what you're describing is people having the practical experience of growing vegetables and fruits, which means that they're going to have some fun doing it, but then they're going to understand the process that goes into making them on a larger scale.
Yeah.
And that increases respect for farmers, inevitably.
Yeah.
Plus, you get to know your farmers if they're in the same neighborhood.
Yeah, and you bump into them in the street. And that's, again, one of the magical things about living in Salmon Arm in the shoe shop. And
You researched, as you said, you do research when you do something. Mm-hmm. You didn't just spring out of the soil fully formed. And it turned out that this program is rather unique. An urban agriculture program in a community is not something that happens all over the place.
No, no.
I think Sherwood Park, you said, was one of the few places that has ever done this. This is near Edmonton.
Yeah.
What have they done? It's a little different. They're
so there, the city actually took it on. And they actually have sat with residents and said, what would you like to see? You know, if we carry down this path, what are your priorities? What is most important? And community gardens was number one. They wanted to see community gardens on city space that serve communities. And that was kind of followed by public agriculture, edible landscaping. So really kind of out there for Edmonton area.
So maybe in the world of governments, local governments are the governments that are best suited to supporting and or initiating projects like this. They're close to the people. They can individualize what they do.
Yeah.
So another project is something that somebody else did elsewhere for a quarter century, and that's called Project Grow. Project Grow is for kids to grow food themselves. Why don't you describe that? And describe the person. Talk about the person who you got to know in Summerland who had done this on her own for a quarter century.
Yeah, yeah. So she started it when she was quite young.
What's her name?
Giselle.
Giselle, okay.
Yeah. So she started a grade 5 garden growing project. And it's still going today.
Do you mean when she was in grade 5?
No, she was...
Okay, just checking.
She focused.
That would be pretty ambitious.
I think she is a very ambitious person, but she wanted to run it through the Summerland Fair. Okay. And I looked at that and I'm going, what a fabulous idea, because one of the things I wanted to do was engage our youth. And we talk about promoting this idea of seeing where your food comes from. Will you have more respect for where the, you know, enjoying your meals? Will you, will it be part of a family kind of adventure growing your own food? So, again, working with Melanie from Food Action Society, it's a perfect fit for them to partner with. Tony over at Buckerfields was a great person to be a go-to for the seeds. And we chose grades or age 9 through 12. And so we started it on April 6th, went live online, and we closed it off mid-May, and we had 65 participants.
And how many did you expect to get or hope to get?
I thought if we had 20, we would have been magic, but 65.
And what they do is they figure out what they want to grow, and then they get the seeds. What kind of process is involved there?
So, good question. So, Jasmine, with Grow and Change Environmental, Horticulture Services. So, she is working with the kids on developing a garden plot. What goes where? How much space is in between? So, again, you know, you look at people that you work with on, you know, I'm a good idea person, but I don't know what Jasmine knows about a garden
plot. The technical aspects.
Exactly. So she would work with them. Then based on that garden plot, Tony would package up seeds and such. And then that participant would then drop by Buckerfields, pick up their seeds and everything they need to get their garden growing. And now we've got photos of these gardens on on our...
So do they plant these seeds in their own gardens at in their homes, or do they? Is there a special plot?
No, it's at home, and it could be in the ground, it could be container, it could be raised gardens. It was whatever.
So you have pictures of kids standing beside their tomato plants as they grow.
You should see it. There's one photo we've got.
I'm sorry, radio listeners, we can't show these things to you, but
you can go.
If you saw the expression on Jim's face, you'd understand what he's talking about.
Go to Facebook, and I think it's a Project Grow. Facebook page, but you'll see these kids that are over the moon happy that their radishes are coming up. That, you know, it's
bring me my radishes, they say.
So the big challenge with this project is judging all these gardens.
Oh, there is a judging process.
Oh, yeah. Ooh. So these are contests, right? So not everybody wins.
No.
But
the radishes win.
The radishes will win. And actually, every family is going to win because they're going to have great vegetables. But the depending on, we've got a criteria set aside. And this is, again, following Summerland's criteria. Mm-hmm. And so there's going to be three gardens that will win. So the first is, and again, we've aligned ourselves with SASCU and the Ag Association. And so we've got our SPs for the top winners.
Wonderful.
So our theme kind of is growing gardens, growing minds. Huh. So with SASCU, they'll manage an RESP, and the top three gardens get...
They get quite a substantial RESP.
Yeah, I think first place is 2,000, and second is 1,000, and third is 500. Yeah. And again, maybe that's just, you know, my coming from Alberta, I thought make it significant enough that people are going to go, wow, this is really cool.
Absolutely, yeah. I couldn't imagine a 9 or 11 year old getting a $2,000 RESP and saying, oh, that just what I expected anyway.
Yeah.
Probably quite excited. Now, there's what we talked about in Indigenous Gathering Place and that project, which is evolving and sounds like a wonderful way to bring people together and have them meet each other and get to know each other better. There's one other project that's going on, and that is setting up an actual garden on Fall Fair grounds.
Yes. Yes. Again, it's Food Action Society is one of our key partners, and we've got that a little plot, and it's funny, in this town already at the board meeting last night, somebody unrelated to our organization or Food Action Society had heard that the little area beside south of the log building on the South Fairgrounds is going to be used for a community garden. And I thought, wow, word travels fast. That
we're just starting to think about it, and they're already talking about it.
Yeah. So this would be a garden that would be a learning teaching center. Would be the nice thing is the proximity to most of those residents that are in need of food and can participate in a community garden. The land itself, we could have turned into an area where people could bring excess fruits and vegetables, and that way we could provide for a donation or just give the residents the food, almost like a gleaning operation.
Yes, yeah. So. Which is something that has been, it's an ancient practice to gather the food in and have it available for people who are in the area or who are in need.
Yeah, yeah.
As we're talking, I have this sense that there's a food sort of revolution slowly taking place. Do you have that feeling sometimes, too, that we're...
Oh, yeah, yeah.
We're moving ahead.
I think what's happened is, and again, COVID kind of woke us all up to how important family community is. And I get a sense that we've got a perfect opportunity, and the fair and the Ag Association in this community, partnering with organizations like the Food Action Society, we are in a great position to drive that forward.
And the board of the fair is recognizing that too. They're giving you a certain amount of freedom to kind of come up with projects like this.
Yeah, it's actually quite nice.
It is nice. It's nice to work for somebody who says, we like what you're doing and we want you to do more of it.
Carry on.
Jim, it's been wonderful to have you on the show today. Your breadth of experience, like that of many guests here, is superb, and it really gives you an opportunity to do something special that kind of experience allows, and gives you an opportunity to share with us as well. We're very grateful to have you on the show. Thank you very much.
It's been my pleasure. This is wonderful, and thank you for the invitation.
Our pleasure, too.